From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carol Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you so much, Carl.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you so much. You're too kind. We have got great show for you today. Later on, we're going to be talking to one Jerry Weintraub, who claims, in his new memoir, to have managed Elvis, Sinatra, Led Zeppelin, and Bob Dylan, plus produced the movies Nashville and The Karate Kid. Right. We expect him to confess he made it all up just to impress some girls. He probably really works in IT. But we are the real deal. We're waiting for your call. The number, 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. It's time to welcome our first listener contestant. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Melissa in Laramie, Wyoming.
Hey, how are things in Laramie?
Kind of chilly. We're at 7,200 feet, and spring comes late.
I understand. Mm. I once spent an interesting evening in Laramie desperately trying to find a place to sleep late at night.
Oh.
It worked out okay. But
soon to be a major motion picture, One Night in Laramie. Yeah.
Produced by Jerry Weintraub.
Melissa, let me introduce you to our panel this week. First, say hello to an actor and comedian and Second City alum, Mr. Keegan-Michael Key.
Hey, Melissa.
Next is the woman behind the advice column Ask Amy, an author of the memoir The Mighty Queens of Freeville, Ms. Amy Dickinson.
Hey. Hi, Melissa.
Finally, it's a humorist and author most recently of Alphabet Juice, Mr. Roy Blunt Jr.
Yeah. Hi, Melissa.
Melissa, welcome to the show. You're going to play Who's Carl this time? Of course, Carl is going to start us off with three quotations from the week's news. Your job, of course, identify or explain it 2 times out of 3. Do that, you win our prize. Carl's voice on your home voicemail. Ready to play?
I'm ready.
Here we go. Here is your first quote.
I have managed to sell a few bonds to widows and orphans that I ran into at the airport.
That is from an email sent by a man named Fabrice Tour. He was one of the bankers at What Firm who had to defend himself in front of Congress this week.
It must be Goldman Sachs.
That is right. Absolutely.
You know what I loved about that?
What was your favorite part of the hearing?
When, they're sitting there talking about financial tools. And I'm thinking, financial tools? Yeah, look in the mirror.
And I'm from Michigan, so I was very proud of Carl Levin. Because when's the last time anyone's dropped any kind of bomb? F, S bomb, D bomb, anything in session like that? I thought that was great.
It was pretty crazy. Well, what happened was that he, of course, was quoting from one of their own emails.
Right.
And he's kept quoting using their vulgar term. We can't say it because we're above the standards of the U.S. Senate.
Right.
But we'll say that he referred to poopy deals. Yeah.
Poopy deals.
Poopy deals.
Nobody has said one word that many times since Allen Iverson. When Allen Iverson.
Yeah.
Practice.
Practice.
Y'all practice stealing from people? You just go, oh, it's practice.
Yes, exactly.
Practice stealing?
They call him Fabulous Fab.
Well, what happened, I should explain, is that there was a Senate subcommittee on permanent investigations. They had these guys from Goldman Sachs. And they can't do anything to them. They can't bring charges, the Senate can. So, but they just tried to shame them. But it turns out the shame is bred out of them in their breeding tanks.
Right. There's no shame to be had.
So they just sat there, stared at the Senate, and they explained this was more or less their excuse. You can't blame us if people were stupid enough to trust us. Mm-hmm. That's what they said. And the senators responded, hey, that's not bad. And they went out to campaign on that slogan. This fall. it's true. I could tell the bankers were not particularly pleased because they left without leaving their traditional 20% tip for Congress.
Whoa. That's a little high for Congress. Huh?
Here is your next quote.
If you don't change your immigration policy, I will have to stop drinking your enjoyable brand of iced tea.
That was from Twitter. It was one angry woman's reaction to the new immigration policy. Where?
In Arizona.
Yes. Exactly right. Arizona passed a law requiring police to check the immigrant status of anyone they, quote, lawfully encounter who they suspect might be illegal. Mm-hmm. Now, what might make the police think somebody is illegal? Not their skin color or accent, oh no. That would be racial profiling. Instead, police will be looking for people who seem really homesick.
Mm. Writing postcards.
Exactly. Just standing right there looking into the distance going,
oh, if only.
Yeah. You should, in Arizona, you should probably not go to a policeman and ask for directions.
No.
Right. That's out. Yeah.
One defender of the bill, a California congressman named Brian Bilbray, said, no, it's not about the skin color or anything else. You can tell people are illegal by the way they dress. That's what he said. Hmm. And he's right, of course, because as we all know, they often wear T-shirts that say, I'm with undocumented. Well, here's a favorite. My mother smuggled me across the Sonoran Desert, and all I got was a low-paying job you people don't want.
You know, I think I heard, isn't like the entire city of San Francisco talking boycotting Arizona?
Well, that's the thing.
That's
a number
hurt.
Of people, including the city of San Francisco, are considering a boycott. By the way, Arizona iced tea made in Long Island.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Ironically, Long Island iced tea comes from a reservoir under Tempe. But here is your last quote.
They would be looking to conquer and colonize. The outcome would be much as when Columbus landed in America, which didn't turn out well for the Native Americans.
That was famed physicist Stephen Hawking. He surprised everybody this week when he warned that we really shouldn't be spending so much energy trying to contact whom?
Was he talking about aliens?
He was talking about aliens. Apparently, Stephen Hawking has been so busy discovering the secrets of the universe that he just got around to watching the movie Independence Day. And apparently, it freaked him out. He's warning us, like, hide from the aliens. His reasoning is any alien race advanced enough to get here are going to be to us as we are to, say, those gnats that you find in your radiator grills after a drive. It's like, oh, I didn't know they were out here. Look at that.
And you can tell aliens by how they're dressed.
That's true. Right, right. Well, our only hope for survival is if the aliens land in Arizona.
Right.
Because they're going to be taken care of.
Immediately arrested, sent on back. Now, if the aliens do come, we've been thinking about it. We have some options. One thing we could do is we could build a whole bunch of fake spaceships and park them.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the aliens come, we pretend we just got here ourselves. And we're like, yeah, I don't know who these guys were who totally trashed this place. When they come back, let's get together and get them.
Right.
Carl, how did Melissa do in our quiz?
Melissa had 3 correct answers, Peter. That means she wins our prize.
Yay. Well done.
All right.
Right now, panel, time for you to answer some questions about this week's news. Keegan, last week, an Iranian cleric said earthquakes were God's punishment for scantily clad women. That's what he said. So as a protest this last Monday, women all over the world wore revealing clothing so as to say, silly cleric, boobs don't cause earthquakes. Then what happened?
Then there was an earthquake.
There was an earthquake.
Yeah, there was an earthquake.
An Indiana woman named Jen McCrate conceived what she called boob-quake. Her term, she said, quote, with the power of our scandalous bodies combined, we should surely produce an earthquake. If not, I'm sure the cleric can come up with a rational explanation for why the ground didn't rumble. But he won't have to, because on Monday there was a 6.9 magnitude earthquake in Taiwan.
Oh. Yeah.
To speak about the now proved influence of cleavage on seismic activity, we are pleased to welcome Dr. Peggy Helwig, a research seismologist at the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory in Berkeley, California. Dr. Helwig, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
And what are you wearing?
You can't see, can you?
No, we can't.
No.
It's on the phone.
Well, I'm an expert in earthquakes because I study them, and I'm an expert in cleavage because I have it.
So you do. So you're... So, obviously, simply applying the rules of cause and effect, the boobage caused the earthquake. Can we not say that for a fact?
I don't think we could say that for a fact. There are, on the average, almost 200 earthquakes every year. That means we of magnitude 6 and greater. There are earthquakes every day that nobody feels.
But surely these can be correlated with the amount of cleavage exposed on a given day. You have this power. You can't you use satellites to check?
I don't think the... resolution is quite that high yet.
Really? I think you're wrong. I think the Pentagon is using their satellites to look down our shirts. That's what I think. No, wait a minute. So if you're saying that boobs don't cause earthquakes, what body part does?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, if the cleric was right, then I think it's not the boobs, it's actually the reaction of the men to the...
Really?
Oh.
So all the men standing around going, ooga, ooga, and their eyes popping out. Let me ask you this. Do you think that breast augmentation can lead to greater earthquakes? For example, does that have anything to do with the increasing number of earthquakes in California?
I honestly don't think so. Right. I think prediction about earthquakes are more like the old German saying, yeah. Wenn der Hahn kräht auf dem Mist, ändert sich das Wetter oder es bleibt wie es ist.
Right, right. Oh. Yes,
that old chestnut.
I was thinking that.
Well, hold on.
So when
what does that mean?
When the rooster crows on the dung heap, the weather stays the same or it changes.
Yay, Germany.
Peggy Helwig is a research seismologist at the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory in Berkeley, California. Dr. Helwig, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for letting me join you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, everybody. Right now, it's time for the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Bluff the Listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play our game in the air. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Jeff Stevens calling from Carrollton, Texas.
Jeff, now, one of the great things about callers from Texas is you always seem to be in different towns. Never the same town twice. So where's Carrollton?
It is a northern suburb of Dallas.
I see. So, mm-hmm. So what do you do there?
I am a software engineer, and my wife and I are raising two wonderful children.
Really?
We didn't ask you about that.
Yeah. Jeff, welcome to the show. Now, you're going to play the game in which you must try to tell truth from fiction. Carl, what is Jeff's topic?
Without second chances, we wouldn't have refried beans.
F. Scott Fitzgerald once said, there are no second acts in American lives. Then again, he was drunk a lot. Our panelists are going to tell you three stories about some well-known people from all over the world who've gone on to do different and surprising things with their lives. Choose the true story. You'll win Carl's voice on your home answering machine and or voicemail. Ready to play?
Yes, I am.
All right. First, let's hear from Roy Blunt, Jr.
We know that the great American poet Emily Dickinson was an ancestor of our own Amy. Which is true. But this week, we learned that the two of them have more than bloodlines in common. Burton McCallum, a Ph.D. candidate at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, has presented a dissertation based on his discovery in previously overlooked archives of the long-defunct Amherst Bugle that for 4 months in 1883, Emily Dickinson wrote the Bugle's Ask Aunt Letitia advice column. What will surprise many is how often Dickinson's columns urge underappreciated wives to take drastic measures. With what you use to beat the rug, give him a walloping. She advised one letter writer, and to another who complained of being ignored, Dickinson's pithy response was, a man will pay attention soon on finding that his hat's ablaze.
Oh, boy.
The Belle of Amherst, giving out hard-nosed advice as an agony aunt. Your next story of an unexpected sequel comes from Keegan-Michael Key.
The Rolling Stones are still going strong, selling out arenas, playing Super Bowls, reminiscing about the War of 1812. But while Mick and the rest of the Stones are on tour getting lucky with groupies, the group's former bassist, Bill Wyman, is wandering around beaches looking for loose change. That's right. The man responsible for the thumping bass lines on Jumping Jack Flash and Brown Sugar is so committed to finding bottle caps and loose bolts, he started a business, Bill Wyman Detectors. And just like you can buy Charlie Watts-style drumsticks and the Keith Richards do-it-yourself blood transfusion kit, you can buy a Bill Wyman signature metal detector. He describes it on his website. Quote, my Bill Wyman signature detector is lightweight, easy to use, and affordable, yet has significant performance levels. Wyman has been all over the English countryside detecting and has made some significant archaeological finds. With any luck, Bill Wyman's rock star status will do for metal detecting what George Foreman did for grills and what Tom Selleck did for Hawaiian shirts. Like they always say, a rolling stone gathers no moss, but on a good day,
It does gather 42 cents in loose change.
Former Rolling Stone bassist Bill Wyman, scanning the sands with his own patented brand metal detector. Your last story of a second act in A Famous Life comes from Amy Dickinson.
Gravel voice talk show host Larry King is a man of many interests. Aside from getting married, wearing suspenders, and lobbing softball questions to his guests, Larry King has a secret hobby, which is about to turn into a business empire. King recently gave an interview to a magazine called Handbag Hobbyist, where he announced his plan to market a line of high-end bags for women. He first became enamored of leather goods when he was divorcing his fourth, or was it his seventh, wife. In the court settlement, he got custody of her extreme purse collection. He's been adding to it, buying vintage bags, and even designing a few himself. King told the magazine, "Go ahead and say it. I'm really into leather. Ha, ha."
From Roy Blunt's story, we heard how Emily Dickinson, in addition to the poetry or after the poetry, became an advice columnist for a local paper. From King and Michael Key, the former bassist for the Rolling Stones, now pursuing his true passion, metal detection. And from Amy Dickinson, Larry King, the talk show host, now getting into exotic leather accessories. Which of these is the real story of a second career after the famous first one?
Wow. Well, the best strategy always seems to be to go with the most outlandish story, but these are all so crazy.
Yep.
I think I'm going to go with number two, just because it sounds like it's maybe possible.
That would be Keegan's story of Bill Wyman of the Rolling Stones making
that's
a metal
right.
detector. All right, well, that's your choice. We spoke to someone who had a rather interesting connection to the real story.
Bill Wyman has always been one of the odder members of the Rolling Stones. 15 years after he left the band, he suddenly reappeared, marketing, of all things, a metal detector.
That was Bill Wyman.
Oh.
Not the Bill Wyman from the Rolling Stones, wow. But the Bill Wyman who used to work at NPR in the Baltimore Sun, who has an intimate connection with Mr. Wyman.
Mm-hmm.
So you were correct. In fact, Keegan had the right story about Bill Wyman's metal detector. You have earned a point for Keegan, and you have earned our prize, Carl's Voice in Your Home Answering Machine.
Well, that's fantastic.
Thank well you. Done. Thanks for playing.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now the game where we ask people who have done a lot to do one more thing. Jerry Weintraub's resume reads like a history of the late 20th century. He helped manage Elvis, Sinatra, Bob Dylan, John Denver, and Led Zeppelin. He produced the movies Nashville, The Karate Kid, the Ocean's 11 series with George Clooney. And along the way, he was best friends with President George H.W. Bush and Armin Hammer. He's written up a bunch of his stories into a new memoir. We hope we can get him to share the more embarrassing ones with us. Jerry Weintraub, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you.
Do you ever look back in your own life and think, come on, that didn't happen?
Yes, all the time. I look back and I'm very, very tired. I'm 72 years old. I feel 92 when I read the book.
You fit in a lot. One of the stories I loved is the story about your first trip, because you grew up in New York. Your father was a successful salesman of jewelry.
Yes.
And he took you all out to L.A. to see the glamorous. This must have been in the 1940s, right, when you made this?
Yeah, 1947.
Right. And you had this encounter with stardom that made you think that you could be one of them someday.
Right. I walked around with my sixth grade autograph book when I graduated from the sixth grade at PS 70 in the Bronx, and I got autographs all over Beverly Hills, Betty Grable and Cesar Romero and Vic Damone and so on and so forth. It was a fantastic place.
And you ran into Betty Grable on the studio lot, right?
I did. She was sitting in the commissary at 20th Century Fox, and she had those beautiful legs up on the table, and then she belched. And it killed it for me.
It killed it? What do you mean?
And I told her that years, years later when we became friends. I said, you know, you ruined my life. You belched when you after lunch. You didn't say, excuse me. It killed me.
One of the things that I note in your stories about your own career is time and time again, you put yourself confidently into situations that you were totally unqualified to do.
Thanks.
No, really. I mean, you tell these stories in yourself, like the story of how you ended up managing Elvis Presley on tour. You said you woke up one day and said, I'm going to take Elvis Presley on tour. You didn't know anybody. You didn't know Elvis Presley.
Right.
You said, I'm going to do this.
It just happened because I believed it was going to happen, and it took me a year to get him, and I had to raise $1 million, and I did. And we had a very, very long run together. I did every show he ever did, and we had a wonderful time.
You do have this ability, again, as you describe in your book, to charm people into doing what you was to your mutual benefit. Is there a trick, Jerry? I mean, you know, here we are. We're all trying to convince people of things. And you were so good at it as a salesman of yourself and your own skills. Is there a trick that you can teach us?
Well, to be serious for a moment, what worked for me for the last 52 years in show business was the fact that I never heard the word no. The word no to me was always an opportunity to make people say yes.
So if I said no to you right now, you wouldn't actually hear it. It'd be like a...
No, I'd hang up. And
oh, okay.
It'd be over. The show
would be over. It'd be done. It'd be over. I'm not going to do that.
Jerry,
I'm kidding.
I wanted to ask a question. Now, it's I can understand, you know, representing Elvis and also Led Zeppelin, but John Denver is such a different direction.
Yeah, John Denver was a great artist. He's the only artist that ever fired me. But other than that, he was a great friend of mine and a great guy, and luckily we ended up friends. It was fine, you know. When he fired me, I was left with a terrible list of artists, you know, Bob Dylan, Led Zeppelin, Presley, Frank Sinatra, at Moody Blues, et cetera, et cetera.
That must have been a dark period, Jerry.
It was a very dark period.
In the book, you tell the story of a prior time that John Denver tried to fire you.
Yes, well, he was in Europe. And he was on tour, and everything was wrong. He hated everything. He hated the venues. He hated the airplanes were no good. The sound systems were no good. Everything was no good. And he said to me, you know, I'm going to fire you. Everything's wrong here. I said, yeah, I know. Sat down with him. I said, John, everything is going to be fine. He said, why? Why? I said, because I fired Ferguson. He said, why did you fire Ferguson? Why? What is firing him going to do? I said, he's been responsible for all the things that you're troubled by, the hotels, the sound system, the venues, the da-da-da-da-da. And he said, it's going to be okay now. I said, yes, I'm putting other people in. Great. And that evening, Denver and I went out to have something to eat. At dinner, I said to him, John, you know, I feel really terrible about firing Ferguson. He said, why? I said, because it's not like you and it's not like me. And John Denver said to me, I agree with you. It's not like us. What can we do to help the guy? It's really not like me. I've got to help him. I said, I'll put him in another area in the company. He'll be fine. We'll take good care of him. He said, that's great. I feel so much better. Of course, there never was a Ferguson.
Right.
Wow.
You tell a similar story about dealing with Led Zeppelin at one point when they thought their concert wasn't
Zeppelin,
allowed.
Yeah, Zeppelin. The first show I did with Zeppelin, it was in New York. Jimmy Page was playing Stairway to Heaven, and when I came off the stage, they called. He wanted to see me right away, and I went backstage and I walked in at Jimmy Page, and Jimmy Page said to me, "I can't hear myself playing Stairway to Heaven. The sound system stinks." And I said, what are you talking about? It's a great sound system. He said, Jerry, there's not enough sound. So I said, okay, I'll fix it for tomorrow night. I'll fix it. I sent my people out, and I got every box in New York I could find. I painted them all black.
Oh my God.
They went up to the ceiling all around the stage. They weren't connected to anything, but they were up on the stage. And Jimmy came out, he played Stairway to Heaven, came off the stage, and he said to me, that's sound.
Wow. So now that you've published these stories in a book, are you afraid that some of these people are going to find out and get mad at you for fooling them back when?
I don't know if they'll get mad at me or not. It's okay.
You could just blame Ferguson.
Right. Okay.
Jerry Weintraub, we've asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Man, I hate my job.
Carl speaks not for himself, but for the millions of people, Jerry Weintraub, who are not like you.
Right.
You've spent your career flying about on private jets with celebrities. We thought we'd ask you three questions about terrible jobs.
Okay.
Get two of these questions right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice, on their home answering machine. So, Carl, who is impresario Jerry Weintraub playing for?
Jerry is playing for Laura Terek of Phoenix, Arizona.
Let's begin with a scientist at Purdue University in Indiana. His name is Andrew Robinson. And once, for scientific purposes, he had to work as a what? Was it A, as a hermit, B, as a bean counter, or C, as a couch potato?
B.
You can go for bean counter? You're right. He had to count beans.
All right.
He was studying different reproductive rates of soybean plants. So every day for months, he had to count the beans day after day after day to see which plant had more beans. Very good. Very good.
Okay.
All right. Next question. Six lucky people were recently hired by the European Space Agency to do what? A, to pretend to be monkeys so the real monkeys, the test animals, wouldn't get lonely. B, see how close they could stand to a rocket firing without being burned. Or C, to get locked inside a fake spaceship for a year and a half.
I would say A, the monkeys.
You're going to say to pretend to be monkeys just to get the real monkeys company?
Yes.
That would be a good job.
Mm-hmm.
But no, the answer was C.
Ooh.
To see if people can survive a trip to Mars, six people have agreed to be locked inside this big mocked-up spaceship.
Right.
And by the way, if they do this, they don't then get to go to Mars. They just get to do this. All right.
Oh, that's
exciting.
Great job.
As a showman, Jerry, you know, you always want to keep it exciting to the climax. That's what we have done.
Right.
If you get this last question right, you win it all.
Right.
Keith Jackson of Britain has one of the most dull jobs in the world. What does Keith Jackson do for a living? A, he watches paint dry. B, he stares at the ceiling. Or C, he twiddles his thumbs.
Twiddles his thumbs.
Twiddles his thumbs? You think that there'd be somebody who would pay you to twiddle your thumbs?
Obviously, if they'd been around in a space station for a year and a half.
He's not in the space station.
Oh, that's all right. I still think he'd twiddle his thumbs.
You think so? You think that's the one? That's your final choice?
Final choice.
Final choice.
Final choice.
I'm afraid the answer was he watches paint dry.
Wow.
As previously mentioned some years ago on this very show, he works as a technician at a paint company, monitoring how quickly it takes for their products to dry. I'm sorry. You know,
I'm
wondering.
Can't they just, like, use a camera? I mean, that's crazy.
Well, you know, you have to go over and you have to touch it to see if it's sticky, apparently.
No.
And could you try to convince me that you were right by picking the other answer? I think you could, actually.
I was right. I was right.
You were right.
I'm twiddling my thumbs now.
And making good money, darn it. Carl, how did Jerry Weintraub do in our quiz?
Well, Jerry needed at least two correct answers to win for Laura Terek of Phoenix, Arizona, but sadly he had just one correct answer.
Well.
Jerry, what did she lose?
What did she lose? She lost the chance to have Carl's voice in her home answering machine.
Oh, well, gosh, there must be a way I can work that out with Carl.
Well, wait a minute.
I bet you could.
Here's our chance. Here's our chance to learn from the master. Carl's standing right here. He's listening. Jerry, what do you got to offer him?
Let's talk, Jerry.
Jerry Weintraub is an award-winning producer, a Hollywood bigwig, and the author of the new book, When I Stop Talking, You Will Know I'm Dead. And it is a charming and funny book filled with great stories about amazing people. Jerry Weintraub, thank you so much for joining us today. What a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. I had a ball.
Bye-bye. In just a minute, Carl travels thousands of light years to bring us this week's limericks thanks to a rift in the space rhyme continuum.
Oh.
If you'd like to play, give us a call at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Right now, panel, some more questions for you from the week's news. Roy, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, in the fight of his life to keep his job in the election next week, now has another problem. On Wednesday, he had to publicly apologize to a voter on live TV for pretending to what?
Well, he pretended. I don't know what he was pretending. He got in the car, didn't realize his mic was live, and called her a bigot.
Right. Well, what we were suggesting was that he pretended to like her. Which you did on live TV. But you're right.
I see what you mean.
It's been a tradition for ages. Politicians have pretended to like voters, and then as soon as they get off alone, they reveal their true feelings.
Yes.
But Gordon Brown is the first one to wear a live wireless mic throughout this Jekyll and Hyde transformation. He was mic'd for video as he chatted on the street with one Jillian Duffy, a grandmother and lifelong Labor Party voter who voiced her concerns about immigrants. Mr. Brown assured her it wasn't a problem, asked about her family, told her how wonderful it was to meet her. Then he got into his car and called her a, quote, bigoted woman and complained about having to talk to her, all the while transmitting his voice to the BBC. After the damning tape was broadcast over and over again on British television and the internet, Brown had to go to Ms. Duffy's house and apologize to her in person. Walking away, he said, quote, that'll keep the little bigot happy. Oh, damn, I did it again.
You know what I loved? When he got in the car, he said something like, who let me near that woman?
Exactly.
Like,
right.
You know,
yeah. Whose fault was that?
Right, it was Ferguson's fault.
Well, I mean, I feel two things. First of all, sympathy, because we've all done that. But also a little apprehension in that, do all the politicians do this? I mean, after telling us, yes, we can, does Barack Obama turn to Rahm Emanuel and say, that guy can't? Amy, in France, there's a bit of a scandal brewing. It all started when a European rental car company, trying to stir up interest in its Citroën hatchbacks, compared the diminutive French car to whom?
The British.
No.
The French.
Remember I said diminutive.
Right.
In France.
Right.
It comes with a sidecar called the Carla, which is actually bigger.
Oh, the Sarkozy.
Yes, they compared it to Sarkozy. The company poster says, be like Madame Bruni, take a small French model. See? many expect a lawsuit from the thin and tiny-skinned Sarkozy. Of course, someone has to pick him up so we can see the poster first. This is just the latest. We have some sympathy for him. This is just the latest indignity suffered by him in regard to cars. Thanks to French safety laws, Sarkozy has to travel in a rear-facing car seat.
What if he drops his sippy cup?
I hate it when that happens. Keegan, in the latest sign that we've all just stopped trying, the Cub Scouts announced a new merit badge in what?
Video games?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Technically...
Gaming, yeah.
It's not a merit badge, but it's something called a belt loop. But the requirements to earn one of these things are quite onerous. For example, and these are real, I'm quoting from their manual, with your parents, create a plan to buy a video game that is right for your age group. Mm. So, okay, steal dad's credit card, click on Amazon, check, done. Here's another one. Quote, with an adult supervision, install a gaming system. Like, hey, mom, watch me as I plug this cord into the flat screen. There. We can't help but see this as a somewhat threatening trend for our youth. Soon they'll be scouting awards for things like eating entire bags of chips, loitering, and finally a scouting award for quitting scouting.
Right.
Oh.
Wow.
And who will tie our knots?
Right.
Exactly. Coming up, it's Lightning Fill in the Blank, but first it's the game where you have to listen for the rhyme. If you'd like to play on air, call or leave a message at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. You can click the Contact Us link on our website, waitwait.npr.org. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Cherie Cortade in Crescent City, California.
Hey, Cherie, how are you?
Good, thanks.
You have a lovely name, Cherie. Now, where is Crescent City? Is that Northern or Southern California?
Northern, right up near the Oregon border.
Oh, it's beautiful up there.
It's gorgeous. We have the Pacific Ocean and the Redwood National and State Park, so
right.
There's lots to see.
What I've heard about that part of California is you can go outside and pretty much almost any plant you find, you can pick up, dry, and smoke, and something interesting will happen. It's like a cornucopia. Just whatever you like. Just try it.
I'll remember that.
Tell us how it goes. Cherie, it's good to have you with us. You're going to play our listener limerick challenge. Carl Castle is going to read you three news-related limericks with the last word or phrase missing from each. If you can fill in that last word or phrase correctly on two of the limericks, you will be a winner. Here is your first limerick.
Though my appetite couldn't be greater, I'd sit out this meal. I'll just eat later. If it's a real skinny dude who is bringing the food, I adapt to the girth of my...
waiter.
Right. According to research by three, count them, three North American universities, dieters are more likely to fall off the wagon if they are served by an overweight waiter or overweighter. Diners feel better about themselves, you see, in contrast. So they're like, I'm not going to feel guilty. And let's just test this concept of the endless pasta bowl. Mm. To get these results, researchers observed a waitress who served some diners while wearing a size 16 fat suit. What we don't get is why, when in need of an overweight participant in their research, researchers turned to a waitress in a fat suit and not pretty much any other American. All right, very good. Here is your next limerick.
In Kiev, Robert's rules have no legs. We're the last parliamentary dregs. If we do not agree, we don't enter a plea. We throw smoke bombs and pelt folks with...
eggs.
Right. In Ukraine this week, politicians met to ratify a treaty to allow Russia to keep its navy on the Crimean Peninsula. And while here it might have just been boring, in the Ukraine it got crazy. Men in suits wrestled and punched each other on the floor of the parliament. Somebody threw smoke bombs and lots of people threw eggs. The speaker and those around him in the front of the room up in the dais, they immediately pulled out umbrellas and used them as shields. That's right. The leaders of the Ukrainian parliament came to a session prepared to be pelted with garbage.
Makes our deliberative bodies look pretty darn good.
It does. Although I do believe President Obama is bringing an umbrella to the next State of the Union. Here is your last limerick.
Cows on the tracks once caused grief. The solution found beggars' belief. We'll use the cow's meat, but no, not to eat. It's a biofuel made of ground
beef.
That's right. This week, Amtrak debuted its brand new beef-powered passenger train. It runs on 80% diesel and 20% biofuel made from beef tallow. It takes passengers between the cow-rich cities of Fort Worth and Oklahoma City. Officials claim the beef fuel reduces carbon emissions by 10% and sulfates by 20%. Amtrak says that on-time arrivals will improve from being rare to medium rare. Carl, how did Cherie do in our quiz?
Very well, Peter. She had three correct answers, and I'll be doing the message on her home answering machine.
Well done. Yeah. Congratulations.
All right.
Thank you so much for playing.
Thank you.
Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train carried my baby home.
Now on to our final game, Lightning Fill in the Blank. Each of our players now has 60 seconds in which to answer as many fill-in-the-blank questions as he or she can. Each correct answer is worth 2 points. Carl, can you give us the scores?
Keegan-Michael Key has the lead, Peter, with 4 correct answers and 4 points. Amy Dickinson has 2 points, and Roy Blunt Jr. has 2 points.
All right, let's flip a coin.
Let's get him, Roy.
All right, let's see if I can screw this up.
All right. We have flipped a coin. Amy is elected to go second, so Roy, you're up first. Please fill in the blank.
All right.
Engineers struggled to cap the undersea well spilling oil off the coast of blank.
Coast of Louisiana.
Right. In an effort to reshape the central bank, President Obama nominated 2 economists and a lawyer to the blank board on Thursday.
Federal Reserve Board.
Right. After a week of speculation, Florida Governor Blank announced he would run for the Senate as an independent.
Charlie Crist.
Right. Police in California were not that surprised that they were forced to arrest a man named Blank for being drunk in public.
His name was, first name was, first initials were I.M., and his last name was drunk.
No.
No, I don't know.
His name was Jim Beam. One of the men convicted of the 1965 assassination of Blank was released from prison on Tuesday.
Malcolm X.
Right. Police in California raided the home of Gizmodo editor Jason Chen as part of their investigation into the lost Blank prototype.
iPhone.
Right. A blind Australian man was refused entry into a restaurant when the proprietors misunderstood and thought his guide dog was Blank.
Was the... what he was bringing to have cooked for him.
No, this is entree. No, they thought his guide dog was a gay dog.
What?
Before entering the restaurant, Ian Jolly asked if he could bring in his guide dog, Nudge. His guide dog.
Oh, guide dog.
Because of his thick Australian accent, the owners thought he said gay dog.
Oh.
Jolly filed a complaint, and the judge awarded them $1,400. When Jolly responded to the thing, oh, good day, mate. The judge thought he called him a gay dog, made him put the money back. As to what a gay dog is and why the restaurant would not want one, yeah. We don't know.
I have never known a dog that would not hump anybody's leg.
Right.
I mean,
honestly, it's pretty true. All dogs are bi. Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No. Right. Apparently, unless you're in a Thai restaurant in Australia. Carl, how did Roy do in our quiz?
Roy had 5 correct answers for 10 more points. He now has 12 points, and Roy has the lead.
Well done.
All right.
All right, Amy, you're up next. Fill in the blank. After a 3-day standoff, the Senate finally agreed to debate on the blank bill.
The financial regulation?
Yeah, financial regulatory reform. After his brother was killed in a plane crash, the twin of the president of blank indicated he might run for the position.
Poland.
Right. Civil rights activist Dorothy Height was eulogized at the National Cathedral by blank on Thursday.
President Obama.
Right. An article in the Philadelphia Daily News about an attack on 2 men wearing Nazi uniforms began with the line blank.
Nazi uniforms, Nazi in this town.
No. How did they not see this coming?
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Although he's recovering from a brain hemorrhage, the manager of reality TV and rock star blank said the star could resume touring as soon as next month.
Poison?
Close enough. Well, Bret Michaels of Poison. You knew that. Good enough. This week marked the 30th anniversary of that popular office supply, the blank.
The Post-it.
The Post-it, yeah.
Oh.
Authorities in California are investigating a voter fraud case in which people were fooled into registering as Republicans by blanking.
Roy got all the easy ones. I don't get that. Like, why? Okay, they were fooled into registering.
They thought they were registered as Republicans, but they thought they were doing what?
Re-registering.
No, they thought they were signing a petition to legalize marijuana.
Crafty.
Ooh. An investigation by the Orange County Register said the main source of the problem was an $8 bounty offered by the California Republican Party for each new Republican registered. But they said that pot advocates were partially responsible for being such easy marks.
Because guess why?
They just baited the petition with Cheetos, and the next thing you know.
Yeah.
Carl, how did Amy do?
Amy had 5 correct answers for 10 more points. She now has 12 points and is tied with Roy Blunt for the lead.
So exciting. All right, how many does Keegan need to win?
4 to tie, 5 to win.
Okay. All right. There we go.
All right.
Here we go, Keegan. This is for the game. Mm-hmm. Fill in the blank. Volunteers across the South began cleaning up in the wake of last weekend's blanks.
Tornadoes.
Right. After finishing a 20-year sentence in the U.S. for drug trafficking, former Panamanian dictator Blank was extradited to France.
Noriega.
To await trial there. Noriega, mm-hmm. Right. Responding to a question from a 4th grader, the mayor of Provo, Utah, revealed that he did not have Blank.
The answer. Did not have a pen.
Did not have a golden toilet. They thought he did. In a golden house. A bipartisan group of senators sent a letter urging the founder of Blank to protect the privacy of its 400 million users.
Facebook.
Right. A Wisconsin woman arrested for shooting blow darts at pedestrians said she had done so because Blank.
Because those damn kids came into my yard.
No, because she liked to hear people say, ouch.
That's fascinating. That was my 46th guest.
It was just a fun afternoon for Paula Wall, sitting in her black minivan, shooting blow darts at people through the window, and then laughing uproariously when they said, ouch. There's no record of what sound she made when she was arrested. Carl, did Keegan do well enough to win?
He needed at least 4 to tie, but Keegan had just 3 correct answers.
Oh, my goodness.
With 12 points, Amy Dickinson and Roy Blunt Jr. are co-champions.
Well done.
Hey.
Roy, I would chest bump you, but my cleavage would get in the way, and then we'd have an earthquake. I so
know. That's worth it.
In just a minute, now that we know that Stephen Hawking is afraid of it, we're going to ask our panelists to predict what will really happen when the aliens finally get here. But first, let me tell you that support for NPR comes from NPR stations. And Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. The National Association of Realtors, providing information for those buying or selling their homes at houselogic.com/buy and sell. And Lumber Liquidators, whose flooring includes pre-finished and stained solid hardwoods, bamboo, cork, and laminates. Information at lumberliquidators.com. Wait, wait, don't tell me is a production of NPR and Chicago Public Radio in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman, executive producer. Philip Godica writes our limericks. Our house manager is Don Hall. Our intern is Christine Fiedler. Our web guru is Beth Novi. Engineers include Les Dolarchik and Muhammad Mao. Thanks to John Zajac at Chase Bank. BJ Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Ian Chillog, Eva Walchover, and Emily Ecton. Technical direction is from Robert Newhouse and Lorna White. The senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Now, panel, what is going to happen when the aliens finally arrive? Amy Dickinson.
Okay, you know that intergalactic superstar, kid singer Justin Bieber?
Heard of him?
Well, when the aliens land, of course, they're going to say, "Take me to your Bieber."
No.
The aliens will be 12-year-old girls. That's exciting. King and Michael Key.
They will join their leader already here, Lady Gaga. Thank you.
And Roy Blunt Jr.
It'll be awkward because it's not like they'll arrive in spaceships. They will just materialize in just weird places. And all of a sudden, there'll be one and they'll have no sense of personal space. And they'll be out in your face saying, "Oh, is that your iPad? Can I play with your iPad? We don't have iPads. Where's your iPad?" And it won't be your iPad. It'll be your macaroni and cheese.
Well, if any of those things happen, panel, we'll ask you about it on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Carol Castle. Thank you to Amy Dickinson, Kiko Michael Key, and Roy Blunt Jr. Thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Peter Sagal. We'll see you next week.
Good.
This is NPR.